This morning we are continuing our series of messages through the Old Testament prophet Hosea. We've called this series Scripture's Soap Opera. As we're going to see, it has all the elements of a television soap opera. And this morning we're going to be looking at the first half of Hosea chapter 2. The title of my message is one word, scandal. Now, the words scandal and soap opera are practically synonymous in our culture. In fact, there was an evening soap opera called Scandal that ran for about 5 years not too long ago. It's a word which we're very familiar with. But what does it mean? I looked up in the Oxford Dictionary and it defines scandal as behavior or an event that people think is morally or legally wrong and causes public feelings of shock and anger. That's a pretty good definition. Pretty well sums up what a scandal is. What you may be surprised to know is that the word scandal appears in the Bible. Not in the English translations of it, but the actual Greek word from which we get scandal appears 15 times in the New Testament, another 25 times in the Greek version of the Old Testament. It's the Greek word skandalon. And initially it meant a trap. Literally it was the piece of wood. You may remember this from either your childhood or seeing or hearing kids doing this. You get like a box and you tip it up so that one end's on the ground but the other end's up high. You put a stick under it to keep it up, and there's usually a string on that stick. Then you put a little bait underneath the box, and when an animal would go in to get the bait, you pull the string, pulls the stick, and the box comes down and traps the animal. Well, the stick in that contraption was called scandalon, and it came to be known as a trap or a stumbling block or an offense. In fact, one very old English dictionary back in the 1600s described scandal as an offense which causes one to take offense. So it's something bad. It's something that causes people to take notice. It shocks them. It makes them upset, enrages them even. That's the idea of a scandal. But in the New Testament, it meant more of something that would cause another person to stumble or trip. Jesus used this word scandalon in a verse you're very familiar with, but you probably wouldn't associate with that term. If you'll remember in the Gospel of Matthew, after the Mount of Transfiguration, they come down off of the mountain and Jesus is telling his disciples, look, the time is coming when the Jewish leaders are going to have me arrested, I'm going to be condemned, and I'm going to ultimately be crucified. And Peter stepped up and said, no, no, Lord, that can never happen. You remember what Jesus said to Peter? Get behind me, Satan. Literally in the Greek, it says, you are a scandal to me. You are an offense. You are a trap. You're trying to get me away from what the Father has planned. So the idea of a scandal. Now, today, scandals are commonplace, and not just in soap operas. Hardly a day goes by that we don't hear about some scandal in the world of politics or entertainment or sports or business. In fact, scandals have become so commonplace, they hardly cause a reaction anymore. I'm reminded of something that you see twice in the book of Jeremiah as he was describing his culture. He says it first in Jeremiah 6:15 and then again in 8:12. Are they ashamed of their loathsome conduct? No, they have no shame at all. They don't even know how to blush. Wow, isn't that capture our culture? We don't know how to blush anymore. Nothing shocks us. Nothing really scandalizes us anymore. It says a lot about the depths to which we have sunk. But in our passage today, we are going to see a scandal in real life that leads to the scandal that was going on that people weren't aware of. What should have caused them to blush, what should have caused outrage, was just being accepted. And Hosea, I will admit, uses some language that we might even consider scandalous ourselves. I was tempted to have a slide on the screen that says parental discretion advised. And honestly, in some, especially some of the Old Testament prophets, it gets very explicit. There are some passages in the Old Testament I would have a real hard time preaching without becoming totally red-faced and probably ducking under the podium. But I have not forgotten how to blush, no. Many times in the Old Testament, God likens his relationship to his people Israel to a marriage relationship, a husband and a wife. And often in the prophets especially, we see that when Israel is unfaithful to God spiritually, he likens that to a wife being unfaithful to her husband, literally. We call that adultery. And God says that when you worship other idols, which they were prone to do in that day, you are committing spiritual adultery against me. And this conduct that should make you ashamed, should cause you to blush, makes me angry. And I am not going to allow it to continue. That's what we're going to see in this first half of chapter 2 in the book of Hosea. You see, Hosea not only could talk about God's perspective of a wayward wife, he lived it. He knew the embarrassment. He knew the pain of rejection. He knew the outrage, as we're going to see, from the scandalous activity of his wife. And he's able to bring that into his message to the people of Israel at that time. Hosea has been called the prophet of love. But unlike a lot of preachers today, he doesn't minimize the holiness of God. Yes, in 1 John 4, the passage we read earlier, we see that God is love. But in that same book, it also says God is light. In him there is no darkness at all. God's love is a holy love. It's not a sentimental feeling that condones sin and coddles sinners. So I invite you this morning to turn to Hosea chapter 2. Hosea chapter 2. We're going to begin with the scandal of Israel's sin. The scandal of Israel's sin. And we see it in the first two verses of Hosea chapter 2. Say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved one, rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife and I am not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. Hosea is using a play on words with Gomer's two younger children. My people is the opposite of the son's name, Lo Am I, as we saw in chapter 1 last week. And you see the reverse of the daughter's name, Lo Ruhama, which means not pitied, not loved, here referred to as my loved one. What does this mean? I believe he is speaking here to those within the nation of Israel who were not following the way of the culture in being unfaithful to God. I think there was a remnant there in Israel. There always is. God always has a remnant. And here he is speaking to individuals within that culture who are truly following God, and he's saying, you need to stand up and say something. Verse 2 tells us what that is. Rebuke your mother. Rebuke her. Now, I know in some of your English translations it says plead with her. And that gives us a completely different feel, doesn't it? When you're pleading with someone, you're begging them, and you could almost imagine little children begging their mother to come home because she had abandoned them. And while that would fit the situation, it doesn't fit the grammar. The grammar here is more like plead a case in court. And that's why the NIV says rebuke her. Why? He goes on, she is not my wife and I am not her husband. That is very similar to the legal language in that day of a divorce. Because in a marriage, God says, I'm the husband and you're the wife, and now he's saying, you're not anymore. I'm done. I've had it. This is not going to continue. And since you won't listen to me, maybe you'll listen to your children. And so he's saying, you rebuke her because of her adultery, because of her unfaithfulness. You say, all right, I understand Hosea's situation. You have Hosea, and he kind of stands for the place of God. You have Gomer, who stands for the people of Israel, you know, the bride of Yahweh that's being unfaithful. Who are the kids? I mean, how do we understand that? I think the best way to make sense of this and to apply it is this. Israel speaks of the nation as a whole. We might say the system. The children are the individuals who live there. Okay? So, as a whole, as a society, Israel has turned from God. But a society is made up of individual people. And so individuals within that society can still be true to God. Does that make sense? Think of our own situation. As a culture, America has, by and large, turned from God. We are no longer one nation under God. I don't care what our money says. That's just not true anymore. But within America, there are people who are faithful to God. So God could say something to the nation, but that doesn't mean that every single person in that nation falls under that category. It's those who are going along with it, those who are living that way, would fall under God's condemnation. Those who do not, he is saying, stand up, speak up. You need to warn the rest of the people of what's going on. So there's the relationship between the children and the mother in this particular text. Now we know from the previous chapter that we saw last week, this was really going on in Gomer and Hosea's household. Man. Hosea and Gomer, and I always end up with Homer. Gomer was unfaithful. In fact, we saw how they first got together, she bore him a son, they called Jezreel. Then it says she conceived and bore a daughter. Hosea didn't have anything to do with that. And she was called Lo-Ruhamah, not pitied, not loved. Then she conceived again and bore another son, not to Hosea. And he was called Lo Am I, not my people, or literally, not mine. Hosea was a master at subtlety, right? That kid is not mine, and you're not loved. But he's making a point. These aren't mine. And what Israel is doing is just like what Gomer had done. We're going to see in the next chapter, next week, Gomer ends up leaving the family altogether, runs off, abandons them, just like overall the nation of Israel had abandoned their God. So this is something that it happened literally in the prophet's home, but God is using this to call attention to what was happening with the nation as a whole. And he says, you are guilty of spiritual adultery. You are being unfaithful to me. Now, they were quite literally guilty of adultery in the physical sense too, because in those days, the idols they were worshiping that were called Baals, these were the idols of the Canaanites that were there from way back when. They worshiped Baal as the god of rain. All right, understand their climate's a lot different than ours. Rain is precious because it doesn't happen very often. But of course, you need to have rain in order to grow crops, right? So they're dependent upon the weather. They're praying constantly for rain. And so the Canaanites devised this god, which they made out of stone, and they prayed to this god that he would send rain so that the crops would grow. In short, he was a fertility god. And how do you get a fertility god to do what you want? Well, you give him the idea of fertility by practicing it as part of the worship. Do you get my drift? They employed male and female prostitutes at the temples of Baal, and basically when the worshipers came, it was a big orgy. Scandalous, right? Shocking. That's what was going on. And that's when God says, you're being unfaithful to me, very literally. That's what was happening in that land. Even by our 21st century standards, this is a scandal. Move down to verse 5. God continues this indictment. Their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived them in disgrace. She has said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my food and my water, my wool, my linen, my oil, and my drink. Notice she is taking the initiative. I will go after them. This isn't someone coming along and alluring her and seducing her away. Oh no, she's the one going out doing it. She is taking the initiative. And the Hebrew here expresses an intense, passionate desire. This isn't something like, oh well, you know, I have anything better to do. There's nothing on TV. Guess I'll go find somebody. No, she is out there. And this is her top priority. Why is she doing this? Is she searching for love? Not really. She's in it for what she can get out of it. You know, look at verse 5. You know, this is where I get my bread and my water. This is where I get my clothing. This is where I get my drink. Where I'm getting my necessities. She's going after these things that her lovers can provide her. There's no affection here. There's no searching for love. This is selfish. This is what can I get out of this? And notice what she says here. They are the ones who give it to me. She is basically giving the credit to Baal for what Yahweh has provided. You really see this in verse 8. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and the oil, who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Try to imagine this. So, and I think you'll be able to catch the emotion behind this. Let's say that you are married and you and your spouse have a child. And then you and your spouse split up and the child goes with your spouse. Now you care about the child and you care about the spouse still. And you support them regularly. You make sure they have everything they need. Well, your ex hooks up with this loser who doesn't have a job, doesn't have money, doesn't have nothing, basically comes in and is living off of what you are supplying to the spouse and the child. And then you find out that your ex is telling your child that their loser friend is the one giving them all that they are living on. How would that make you feel? Pretty ticked off, right? And that's what God is feeling here. That's the idea. That same emotion that we would have, God is having because He is the one that provides the rain. He's the one that provides the food and the drink and the shelter and the clothing. Everything the Israelites have is coming from God, and they're saying, look at what Baal has done for us. And Baal is a rock. Does nothing, and yet they're giving all of the praise and the credit to the God instead of the true God, who is indeed giving everything they have. Yes, God is upset. We can understand His feeling behind this. God has given them not only the bare necessities they need, look, it says even the silver and the gold, above and beyond. But what are they doing with the silver and gold? They're making idols out of it. They're plating their rock with silver and gold and saying, this is our God. Just like the Israelites did with the golden calf in the wilderness. And God says, I've had it. I'm done. This scandal ends. But He goes on to describe the shame of Israel's sin. And here's where I probably need to warn you. Some of the language here may be a little scandalous. Verse 3. The end of verse 2 says, let her remove the adulterous look and the unfaithfulness. Otherwise, verse 3, I will strip her naked and make her as bare as the day she was born. I will make her a desert and turn her into a parched land and slay her with thirst. I will not show my love to her children because they are children of adultery. Here God moves from the charges to the consequences. Because you are guilty of this scandalous activity, this is what's going to happen. I am going to bring shame on you. Talks here about exposing her, stripping her naked. And there is evidence from the ancient world that unfaithful wives and even prostitutes, when they were caught and they were publicly punished, they were often stripped naked to endure their punishment. And you see this later on, the Romans adopted this with crucifixion. Not only was crucifixion the most agonizing way to die, it was the most embarrassing way to die. Because you're just put out there for everybody to see. And that's basically what God is saying here. I am going to expose you. You are going to be like you were naked. And if you think about it, that shame of nakedness goes all the way back to the beginning, doesn't it? Remember Adam and Eve in the garden? They're bebopping around naked and they didn't care. Didn't bother them until they sinned. And then all of a sudden it says their eyes were opened, which is what the serpent said would happen. And they saw that they were naked. And what do? They hide. They're trying everything to cover themselves up, right? God comes along and says, where are you? Adam says, we were naked till we hid. Who told you you were naked? I mean, they were naked the whole time. But how did you figure it out? Because of sin. See, sin brought shame. And it wasn't the nakedness that was shameful. It was their awareness of it. Now all of a sudden, they're ashamed. They were ashamed of their sin. Now, we know the rest of that story. After their pathetic attempts to try to cover up, God graciously provided coverings for them. But here is the beginning of the clothing industry, right? Up until now, you didn't need it. Because we hate to be caught in that state? What's a common phrase that we use of being embarrassed? Someone gets caught with their pants down, right? You know, we hate that. You ever had that dream when you're somewhere, you know, you're in school or you're at church, you're somewhere in public, you go to work, you know, and you realize I don't have my pants on, right? That's embarrassing. Well, that's part of who we are. And God says, when you sin, when you act in such a scandalous way, I'm going to make you ashamed. Just like you've got no clothes on out in public. That's the consequence of the action. The Lord continues in verses 9 and 10. Therefore, I will take away my grain when it ripens and my new wine when it is ready. Notice he says there, my. My grain, my new wine. Why? Because he's the one that provided it. They might attribute it to the Baal. God knows where it really came from, and now Israel's going to know where it came from because they're not going to have it anymore. You're relying on Baal to supply you with this? Fine, I'm going to not, and let's see what happens. You're not going to have anything. I will take back my wool and my linen intended to cover her nakedness. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. That last line is kind of telling. Because God is talking about the shame he's going to bring on the Israelites. But that last line says, no one's going to take them out of my hand. Tells you that God hasn't given up totally on them. And here's the reality of the situation. Under Israelite law, a spouse guilty of adultery could be put to death. God had every right to wipe Israel off the face of the earth and be totally done. They deserved that. But right here we see just a little hint of God's grace. I could rightfully destroy you, but instead, I'm going to work toward restoration. Instead of taking revenge, which nobody could fault me for, nobody could complain if I decided that I'm going to take revenge on what you have done to me, I want to make a pathway for restoration. And that's where we move into the last point, the scarcity from Israel's sin. Go back, if you would, to verse 6. Therefore, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers but not catch them. She will look for them but not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my husband as at first, for then I was better off than now. Here's the end game God has in mind. It's not destruction. It's not, I'm done with you, I'll go find somebody else. Remember that back in the wilderness where God kind of said that? I'll wipe them out and make another group just like me. And Moses said, no, don't do that. God says, I have every right to destroy you, but instead, I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to bring you back to myself. But the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to cut off everything that you think you're getting from your lovers until you come to your senses. That last line says, then she'll say, I will go back to my husband because I was better off than that. You know what that reminds me of? Prodigal son. Remember that story? He couldn't wait to get his hands on dear old dad's inheritance. I want it now. And he took that and he went off to a far distant country. And man, he was living it up. Partying all night and probably sleeping every day. You know how that goes. And it was great until the money ran out. Then all of his friends ran out too. And it got so bad, the only job he could find was feeding pigs. Can you imagine that for a good Jewish boy? Ooh. And it got so bad that the stuff he was feeding the pigs started looking appetizing. Ugh, you ever seen what they feed pigs? That's never looked good to me, let alone smell good. And it says, then he came to his senses. And he said, I was better off back where I was. My father's servants have it better off than this. I'm going to go home. That's what God's doing here as well. He has not given up on his wayward wife. He's saying, I will bring her back. I will restore her, even though it's going to take drastic measures to get there. See, the reason that God was depriving her of all these things she needed was so that she would return to repent from that idolatry. They needed to have their freedom taken away so they would have no choice but to go back. You see this amplified beginning in verse 9. We already read 9 and 10, but this gives the whole context. Therefore, I will take away my grain when it ripens, my new wine when it is ready. I will take back my wool and my linen intended to cover her nakedness. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals, her new moons, her Sabbath days, all her appointed feasts. I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were her pay from her lovers. I will make them a thicket and wild animals will devour them. I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals and decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after her lovers. But me, she forgot, declares the Lord. The picture here is almost vicious. Take away in the Hebrew means snatch away. It's like you would snatch prey out of the mouth of an animal. God's resorting to drastic measures to get the attention of his wayward people. Verse 11 speaks of religious celebrations that would stop. And he's not talking here about Baal worship. He's actually talking about his worship. The Sabbaths, the new moons, the yearly festivals. This was part of Israelite religion. Do you know what this suggests? This suggests that all along, the Israelites were still going through the motions of worshiping Yahweh. In our language, we would say they were still going to church every week. They were going through the motions. They were there at those monthly times and those yearly times. They were there, we would say, for Christmas and Easter, right? They were still going through the motions of worshiping Yahweh, but the whole time they're saying, man, I hope he gets done soon so I can go home and fill in the blank. Just going to church didn't cut it. God said, I'm going to make it so they won't even have that opportunity. The reference to jewelry later on, verse 13, yeah, that's the stuff they weren't getting their Sunday best to go to church. That's what they decked themselves out with to go to the shrines, because that's where the action was really happening. And you wanted to make yourself as attractive as possible for all those male and female prostitutes that were there. All the things that they bought with Yahweh's money, they were spending on Baal. Not anymore. God says, I'm going to take it away. But I think worst of all is that last phrase in verse 13. But me, they forgot. J. Vernon McGee says it, the greatest sin of all is to forget God. To act like he doesn't even exist. You say, well, how can someone forget God? By the way they live. Oh, we can mouth our belief in God, but if our behavior doesn't back it up, what good is it? Some preachers like to call this practical atheism. You might say you believe God exists, but you don't act like God exists. You act like he doesn't exist. You can do whatever you want, and it doesn't matter. We see a lot of that today, too, don't we? So what do we learn from this first half of Hosea 2? Hosea saw very clearly the consequences of Israel's sin, and it grieved him. We learn that love is not harsh, but it can be stern. And not only does God say he's going to punish Israel for her sins, but we see that sin kind of has its own built-in punishment. But what Hosea also saw with equal clarity was that though Israel was destroying herself with her spiritual adultery, she was not destroying God's love for her, because she couldn't. God's love was sure and steadfast no matter what happened. Hosea's theme is that the unfaithfulness of God's people does not nullify the faithfulness of God. And that is still true today. I'd like to conclude with a rather long quote from John Stott that I think really summarizes this perfectly. He says, "It's all very well to poke fun at Israel for her primitive superstitions, her fertility rituals at the Baal shrines of those days. It's all very well to poke fun at them. Our own more sophisticated unfaithfulness is not nearly so funny, especially when, like Israel, it is accompanied by religious zeal. Outwardly, we may still conform to the requirements of Christianity. Oh yeah, we go to church, and we're there on Sunday morning. We conform to what is expected of us outwardly. We appear to be Christian people, highly respectable. And our friends and relatives don't suspect anything that could be amiss secretly. But underneath, inwardly, it may be some of us here no longer walk with God. Our heart is far from Him. We've lost our first love. Sin in Christians is not just a regrettable lapse from conventional behavior. It is unfaithful treachery, spiritual adultery, giving to others the love and loyalty that's due to God alone." You know, we come across this not infrequently in the New Testament. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 11, verses 2 and 3, "I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, Christ, so that I may present you as a pure virgin to him. But I am afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds might be similarly led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ." Likewise, James 4:4 says, "You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred toward God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God." I wonder if James hadn't been reading Hosea and his devotions that morning when he wrote that, equating that adultery to being spiritually unfaithful to God. I think that's the first lesson we learn. Let's not whitewash sin. Don't say everybody else is doing it. Whatever happened to sin? It was actually a title of a book a number of years ago. Today it's been redefined in terms of nonconformity or being a little deviant from convention. Maybe going my own way, doing my own thing. Christians have no business to fall into that trap. Don't whitewash sin. Don't minimize the sinfulness of sin. Sin is spiritual adultery and even prostitution. End quote. Ooh, that's a little harsh. That might even be scandalous. But is it true? That's really the bottom line. See, we may be just like Israel. We may just be just like Gomer. We were found, we were loved, but now we've run away from the prosperity and the delight of God's love. We've run from our Lord. We have offered all that He gave us to other gods. Yesterday at our men's breakfast, we talked about that last verse in 1 John. In almost every English translation, it says, "Dear children, keep away from idols." And that's literally what the Greek says. But I love the way the Living Bible paraphrases it. "Dear children, don't let anything take the place of God in your hearts." Because that's really what idolatry is. Idolatry isn't bowing to some tree or some rock. Idolatry is letting anything take God's place in our lives. That's what was happening in Hosea's day. Sadly, that's what's happening today. But God isn't ready to give up on us. God is always willing to call us back. Your life might be a scandal. Your life might be just like a soap opera. Maybe not on the outside. Maybe nobody else knows, but inwardly, spiritually, you may be just like Hosea's wife, Gomer. You're looking for love in all the wrong places. You're putting everything else before God. You're crediting everything else for what God is giving you. It's time to stop the scandal. Time to turn off the soap opera. It's time to get serious with God once again. Because this love story hasn't been finished. We're going to see there's a drastic change. There's always a twist, right, with a soap opera? Always a twist in the story. We're going to see a huge twist next week. And there can be a huge twist in your life story as well. Come back to God. He's still there waiting. He still loves you. He is extending His grace. You can turn your scandal into the greatest love story ever told.